This episode of Harvey Brownstone Interviews is brought to you by the Harvey Brownstone Talk Show Blend Coffee, available at HollywoodBlends.com. Everyone's saying it's the best coffee they've ever tasted. Why not give it a try and see for yourself?
Hello, everyone. I'm Harvey Brownstone, and today's guest is a true giant in the music world. Although he may not be a household name, I guarantee that you've heard his music multiple times and in a variety of mediums. He's a multi-award-winning record producer, musician, songwriter, film and TV composer, and music director who first came to international prominence in the late 70s when he produced Dan Hill's albums, most notably Longer Fuse, which produced the classic Grammy-nominated hit song, Sometimes When We Touch. He went on to make critically acclaimed records with some of the greatest superstars in music history, including Jimmy Webb, Kris Kristofferson, Johnny Mathis, Carole King, Billy Joel, Glen Campbell, Linda Ronstadt, Willie Nelson, Natalie Cole, Chris Stapleton, and believe me, I'm just scratching the surface. He also spent 17 years as a highly successful composer for television and film, writing scores for major motion pictures like Hanoi Hilton, Fast Company, Spring Fever, The Fall, Friday the 13th, The New Blood, and Jason Takes Manhattan, as well as for the Friday the 13th TV series and many other hit TV shows, including Beverly Hills 90210, Hard Copy, Outer Limits, and My Secret Identity. He also composed the music scores for dozens of TV movies, including Amy Fisher, My Story, Little Criminals, White Lies, and Daydream Believer, The Monkey Story, on which he also served as music director. He's also been the vice president of A&R for Walt Disney Records and produced a whole slew of children's lullaby albums under the Disney label, as well as executive producing the blockbuster show and CD, High School Musical, The Concert. Our guest has won 3 Juno Awards, a Gemini Award, and 5 SOCAN Awards. And now he's released a highly insightful and terrifically entertaining memoir entitled Unplugged, Stories and Secrets from a Life of Making Records, Scoring Film, and Working with the Legends of Music. I'm delighted to welcome the iconic music man himself, Fred Mollen. Fred, thank you so much for being here.
Who are you talking about?
You.
Oh my God, that was a long intro. I'm so honored to have had that intro. Thank you.
My pleasure. Fred, you're a self-taught musician. You've been playing the guitar since you were 11. You had the guts to quit school at the age of 16 to pursue a music career. And from what I can tell from your book, your parents were supportive of that, which is highly unusual. It's incredible, don't you think?
Yeah, thank you. You know, I quit school at 16 in 1969, and I was in a sort of a middle-class area of Long Island, Merrick, Long Island, and my parents were not surprised. I mean, my mother was incredibly supportive, and my dad was too, but my mom was really the wind under my wings on many levels. And when I said, listen, I really want to get going with my music, they understood, and my mom walked me into the high school the day of my birthday, and we got rid of high school, and away I went, you know, trying to make a life in music. And I'm 72 now, so I can say that I've done it, which is continuing as we speak. I'm in the middle of other projects, so I'm still going. And I'm very proud to say that, you know, this high school dropout did reasonably well. Yeah.
That's an understatement. You started out as a singer-songwriter wanting to be the next James Taylor or Neil Young, but you didn't think you had what it took to make it really big because you felt your life wasn't tortured enough and that you hadn't suffered enough. But now that you've met so many singer-songwriters, do you think you were right that you have to suffer a lot to make it big?
First of all, these are great questions. And obviously you read parts of the book, if not the whole book. I thank you for that, Harvey. You know, when I was starting out, which was, you know, 69, 70, I wanted to be a singer-songwriter at that point, you know, in the mold of a James Taylor, Neil Young, Jackson Brown, Joni Mitchell. And, you know, all of those folks, a lot of them I got to know, you know, over the years. Certainly, you know, many of the songwriters that I call the autobiographical singer-songwriters, they really did have a lot of pain in their lives. And the way they got it out was to write great songs, and they channeled that pain into wonderful, incredible, powerful songs. I didn't have that kind of growing up. I didn't have any trauma. So for me, the simplest way to make music, I realized a few years later, was to help others by producing them and arranging their music.
In the mid-70s, you joined up with Matthew McCauley. You got to know Dan Hill. You began producing Dan's albums. Your first big hit single was Sometimes When We Touch, which is one of the 200 most played songs in the history of radio. But I read that you never received the royalties you were entitled to on that record. Is that right?
Yeah, it's a cautionary tale, Harvey. You know, when we did the record, it really was a smash, and it was a worldwide smash, and we were just kids. I was 23, my partner, Matt, was 22, and Dan was 22. And the label out of L.A., which was the U.S. distributor of the album, because the album was recorded in Toronto, we had a deal with 20th Century Fox Records. And 20th Century Fox Records was fine, but the Canadian home label, which was GRT, who had signed Dan initially for the first of the three albums, they went bankrupt and didn't tell anybody. And so we had to be frantically trying to find a way to get the money that they had owed us, basically starting right at that time. Like, the big money was coming in right when they went bankrupt. And frankly, for the next 3 years, all those royalties that would have come to me were never received.
It's unbelievable. I've had so many music stars on our show, including Gary Lewis and Tommy James and so many others, who really got screwed by their record companies. And it happened to you too. I'm so sorry about that. Now, in the late 70s, the legendary Clive Davis offered you the chance to produce Melissa Manchester's recording of Don't Cry Out Loud, one of Peter Allen's greatest songs, but you turned it down so you could produce an album by Randy Adelman, who appeared on our show a few years ago. So I know, Randy. Have you ever regretted that decision?
You know, we didn't decide not to do Melissa's single. The story is actually pretty interesting, because it's, again, it's a cautionary tale, and it was a learning curve for me. I was still very young. We were all 24, working in L.A. for Clive Davis as staff producers, and we were working on an album that he suggested we work on, which was Randy Edelman's album. And Randy was a terrific songwriter, but hadn't sold records. But it was still a lovely record to do, and we loved working with Randy. And so here we are in Los Angeles, fresh from Toronto, and, you know, again, sort of wide-eyed in Babylon, and working for Clive Davis. We just had the hit. And in the middle of Randy Edelman's album, we got a phone call. I got the phone call. I was in the Chateau Marmont Hotel where we were living under Arista's benevolence. And I got a phone call in the morning from Clive. And up to that point, we'd always had a lovely, you know, relationship with Clive. And he considered us his boys, et cetera. And, you know, he called and he said, "Fred, I have a great opportunity for you and Matt." And I said, "Oh, this is wonderful. What is it?" He said, "Well, I know you like Melissa Manchester, and she's got another single that we want to do, and it's an incredible song, and we want you to produce it." And I'm like, "Well, this is wonderful." And the first thing I said afterwards was, "So will you be calling Randy and letting him know that we'll be on hiatus until we're back from that single?" Or should I speak to Randy? And he didn't waste a second. He said, "You didn't get it, do you? You don't get it." Hung up the phone. And 5 minutes later, Harry Maslin was hired to produce Don't Cry Out Loud. And very soon afterwards, our deal with Arista fell apart. Yeah.
So what was it that you think he meant when he said, "You don't get it"? What didn't you get?
That I shouldn't give a shit about the artist that I was working with and just do whatever he told me to do. So the lesson really is, when the boss calls and says you to do something, you do it.
I just would have loved to see how your interpretation as a producer of that song, Don't Cry Out Loud, sung by the magnificent Melissa, who's also been on our show, would have been different than what ended up happening. We'll never know.
I'll never know. I think we would have worked hard to do a great job. But, you know, listen, again, this is spilt milk, but also they're life lessons.
Yeah, they really are. I would never have thought that simply by asking, "Will you tell Mr. Adelman or do I have to do it?" would spur such a reaction. It's really a disappointment.
It was so impatient, Harvey. It was just literally, "You don't get it. Click."
And then for a while, you worked as a songwriter for Chapel Music, and your song Fast Company was recorded by Cher on her Black Rose album. Did you like her version of the song?
You know, I was thrilled that she cut it. I got to meet her after she had cut it at the studio. It was like meeting, she was so out of it. It was like meeting Dracula. But I didn't love her version. No, I thought it was okay.
It was a very tough time during her career when she recorded that album.
It was a big failure, that album. So yeah.
It was a failure, though, because she created an image that the public didn't want. That wasn't the Cher we knew and loved. It wasn't because of the songs, and certainly not because of your song. It's a great song.
Thank you. Well, yeah, it was her trying to be sort of a hard rocker, and they didn't even call it a Cher album. They just called it Black Rose. And so it just really failed, which was too bad, because I would have liked to have had a hit with that.
And you deserved it. I want to ask you about your work as a record producer. You described yourself in the book as a nurturing producer. And Amanda McBroom refers to you as a selfless producer because you put the artist's vision first and you leave your ego at the door. How did you develop that particular method of dealing with artists?
Again, these are really good questions, and I thank you. I'm so not selfless in other parts of my life, I guess. My children will tell you, they're 37 and 40 now, but they'll tell you that, oh yeah, that selfless person that Amanda was talking about is not my dad, you know, because there's, you know, we all have our ability to be selfish at times and more sort of egocentric. But with my artists early on, I think even with Dan Hill, I learned to really just be constructive and then realize that my job was not about me. It was my job to make their vision, the artist's vision or their dream come true by working with them and supporting them emotionally through it. It's really sort of similar to being an artist's director, you know, like, you know, you've heard about people who are just great with their actors, right? You know, an artist director is really what I was in, like an actor's director in film. And I think it came naturally to me to have empathy and want to give a lot to them. And then maybe when I got home, maybe I wasn't so selfless. I'm sorry.
But I think that your intuitiveness and your people skills and your ability to make artists feel comfortable and supported brought out the best in them. And one of the most impressive things about you as a record producer is that you don't have a signature sound or style. You're not Phil Spector. You want every record to reflect the style of the artist. And you work mostly with solo artists, not bands. Why is that?
Well, first of all, again, thank you. I do feel like I give the artist the chance to make their album. And I want them to know that I'm there to shepherd them through the album. And that's my job. And some artists, by the way, need a lot of work, a lot of help. You know, they may need me to really help arrange the music, even sometimes co-write the songs. But there's many artists I work with who are very fully formed. And I'm just there to truly direct the proceedings and help them get through that album with a lot of joy and a lot of spirit and passion. You know, I learned early on, and I have to remember, I started producing Dan Hill, that was 1974. So I was 21 when I started Dan's first album. I think initially what I loved was working with studio musicians and the artist. That was exciting to me because the virtuosity and being able to help direct the music, that was great for me. When you work with a band, first of all, you got to be a psychiatrist for all members of the band. And that's rough because I'm good with one person or two. But when it comes to five or six, and then you have one guy who maybe isn't as good or maybe is more screwed up. And, you know, I found that the few times I've produced bands, it was really tedious and I didn't like it.
Well, in the book, you said the most challenging aspect of being a producer is compiling the vocals, creating one track from a number of vocal performances. Have you ever had a disagreement with an artist over a vocal compilation?
No, because the artist has the final say. I never, you know, the whole record is not done until the artist says, I love this, it's done. You know, so any vocal comping that we would do, meaning taking different passes of a vocal and looking for the best parts of each one to make it an even better vocal. I'm really good at it, unfortunately, because it's the hardest job I have, but apparently I'm good at it. And the artist, you know, if they don't like something I've put together, and by the way, Harvey, sometimes, at least half the time, the artist will be with me while I put the vocal together. So we're very much doing it together. But, you know, when I do bring something to the artist, play something that I've comped, I would say 95% of the time they love what I've done. And there may be 5% where they say, gee, that one word or that one line, can I sing that over again? Or can we find a better one?
Quite an amazing process that I learned so much from your book. And you know, Fred, when we had legendary record producer Rob Fraboni on our show, he said one of the hardest parts of his job when he's working on a record is to know when to stop. When is it finished? Do you feel the same way?
Yeah, I think great art is knowing when to stop. I think that's a great truth. And I think that there is clearly, I listened to the records I did early on, and I'm absolutely aware that, you know, I learned more about leaving space and being able to not add too many more things to something, you know. And so I think that's very true.
I want to ask you about some of the legendary artists you've worked with, starting with one of my favorites, Johnny Mathis. You produced two of his albums, Let It Be Me, Mathis in Nashville, and his 2013 holiday album, Sending You a Little Christmas. What was he like to work with?
Well, first of all, I'm very proud to say I've actually done three albums with him, because the Christmas album we did that came out 2 years ago, Christmas Time Is Here, was the third one I had done with John. And he's the kindest, most amazing, loving, brilliant artist I've ever imagined to work with.
I can't get over that his voice doesn't seem to have diminished over the years. Isn't that shocking?
It's shocking. He just turned 90, and his voice... I saw him play in December, and his voice is singing in the same keys that he sang in when he was 20. And it's absolutely this magical continuation of that beautiful sound. And it's so rare. I mean, I've worked with so many veteran artists, and by the time they hit their 70s, even, their voice is a little more craggy, and, you know, there's more hoarseness or whatever. And it's understandable. That's just physics and the physicality of what they do. John, he's a miracle. Yeah.
Yeah, what a miracle, and what a great performer. You also produced Kris Kristofferson's album, The Austin Sessions. You described him as the Shakespeare of country music, and you said he was a stand-up comedian without even trying. I never thought of him as being funny. Did his sense of humor come as a surprise to you?
No, it didn't come as a surprise. I mean, someone that intelligent who wrote those kinds of songs, you know, is going to be bright enough to be funny. And he was just very self-deprecating and had wonderful stories. He was a great storyteller and also was a great laugher. I mean, he really just had a wonderful sense of humor both ways. And so that was an absolutely delightful experience to make that record and to continue to sort of spend some time with Kris here and there for the next few years. And I didn't keep in touch because, you know, he was living in Hawaii and he, you know, was sort of semi-retired a lot of the time, but I just adored the guy. And he was just, again, just one of the great experiences of my life. Yeah.
And what a great album that was. I want to ask you next about my friend, Bill Medley. He was on our show a few months ago. You've worked with him a few times, most recently on his country album, Straight From The Heart. Was he fun to work with?
Oh my God, Bill is the greatest. I mean, Bill is the, you know, the baritone bass voice of the Righteous Brothers, who of course did You Never Close Your Eyes Anymore. And that's Bill. So again, talk about iconic voices. I mean, this is unbelievable. And of course, I Had the Time of My Life. That's Bill, you know. So I've worked with Bill. I produced him years ago with an idea he had to sing with his daughter and son. And we became great friends over that. And I just reached out to him probably now about 2.5 years ago. And we had dinner in Nashville. And I just said, I have a great idea for you. I really want to produce it. And I said, I want you to do an album with me of the classic old country songs, Hank Williams, Johnny Cash, you know, these kinds of songs, and do it in a very unplugged, intimate manner that really is sort of a classic Americana version of these songs, but with your voice, it'll have such gravity. And the album is called Straight From The Heart. I think it's an absolutely historic record. And Bill's voice is very hoarse now and very craggy, but boy, oh boy, does it sort of makes those songs live in a whole more gravity-filled place.
Absolutely. I told him last week that you were coming on the show. He asked me to give you his warmest regards, and he said, Harvey, you better give Fred as good an interview as you gave me. So I want you to know I'm trying hard.
You're doing a great job, and I love Bill. He's such a sweetheart. I've been so lucky, Harvey. I mean, I've had so few bad experiences.
Which is quite amazing in show business. And I think, if I'm not wrong, the vocalist you've worked with the most is Michael McDonald. In your opinion, what makes him so special as an artist?
Well, I started working with Michael. I fell in love with his voice on a Steely Dan album that he had sung on when he was like 19. and which means I was 20. And he then joined the Doobie Brothers, I think in, you know, whatever, I'm thinking 77 maybe. And I heard that voice on Taking It to the Streets and those songs. And I said to Matt, my partner at that time, when we were producing Dan Hill and a few other artists, and at that point we had just signed with Clive to do some production for him, that we had an album, actually, I think it was, it was a singles project, but I called Amigo Studios in North Hollywood and out of, you know, out of the blue, asked for Michael and found him there because they were making another Doobies album. And I introduced myself and I said, hey, would you sing backgrounds on the stuff we're doing? We're going to come to LA. We'll come specifically to record your background vocals on these two songs. And he was like, yeah, yeah, of course I will. Yeah, no problem. You know, and so we became very fast friends ever since. And he has sung backgrounds for me on so many incredible duets on so many different projects over the years. And we remain very, very close pals. I produced his wife, Amy Holland. I did her last album. But Mike and I go back a very long way, and we're close, close friends. And he's, oh, and you were asking me what makes him amazing. Well, he has the greatest, I think, the most powerful, the most passionate, the most brilliant soul voice of any white person. And his hero and who he was inspired by was Ray Charles. And interestingly, you know, a lot of people were. So Bill Medley, for instance, was devoted to Ray Charles. Michael was devoted to Ray Charles. Very different voices. But when Michael does his stuff, there's no better R&B soul voice out there, especially, I mean, the fact that he's blue-eyed soul is amazing.
And what a range, what a range. Well, I have to tell you, one of the most emotional parts of your book for me, and yes, I did read the whole thing, you produced Linda Ronstadt's very last recording, which is a duet with Jimmy Webb called All I Know. That must have been a really emotional experience for you.
It was a big deal for me. You know, we had known, because I'm very close with Jimmy. He's part of my extended family. I've worked with Jimmy Webb almost all my adult life. So we're sort of like, you know, he's like a big brother. And Linda was very devoted to Jimmy and cut a lot of Jimmy's songs and got to know Jimmy very well over the years. So she had told Jimmy a little before we asked her to do this duet that she was having problems with her voice and that it wasn't psychological and that she was no longer going to sing. And Jimmy called her and basically asked her for a favor because we decided we had a very intimate version of All I Know, this beautiful song that Jimmy had written for the two duets albums I did with Jimmy. And we both said, boy, wouldn't that be great if Linda sang this? And Jimmy called Linda and Linda capitulated eventually and said, you know, as long as I can approve it, she said, and he said, as long as Fred Mullen comes to San Francisco and helps me and produces the vocal. And I was gobsmacked because, you know, I held her in such high esteem and I had never met her before. I had just been, you know, an absolute crazy fan. And I heard a lot about her over the years from Jimmy. So when Jimmy told me that story, I was just stunned. And I said, when do I leave? You know, and so 2 days later, I flew to San Francisco and we had dinner and I just adored her. I fell in love with her. She was just the most amazing, super bright, brilliant, wonderful, passionate. I use this word a lot today, but so, you know, that's a key in musical. The things that make music so great is passion. Anyway, she was so wonderful, but she did say to me, I've lost my voice and it's something physical. They've checked everything. They can't figure out what's going on. And then she said, listen to this. And she sang a scale. Da 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 da, and she went da 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 da, and it would crack every other note, and she said, I cannot control my voice, and I said, I was heartbroken, and I said, well, do you still want to try this? And he said, well, we have the studio booked. He said, I'll give it a try, but she said, I cannot promise you anything, and so we spent the whole day at a small studio in San Francisco, and we had a really lovely time together. I was obviously extremely sensitive to take good care of her. She tried the lines. We got enough to work with, but she was absolutely having incredible problems compared to the real Linda Ronstadt. But she was able to get enough on tape that I was able to bring it back to Nashville and put a composite together, played it for her. And she said, oh, that's good. I'll let it go. And so it's on the album. It is her last recorded vocal. And yes, of course, it was highly emotional. Again, a day I will never forget. It was absolutely priceless.
And what a tribute to you. And I'm surprised that you were surprised when she said, well, if Fred Mullen will come, then I'll do it. You are far more beloved and respected within the industry than you realize, sir.
It's times like that when you are, I'm just so humbled. I really am.
So, and when you were making one of your Disney albums, you worked with the Jordanaires, Elvis Presley's famous backup vocalist, and you got to sing Teddy Bear with them. That must have been a bucket list moment for you.
That's a great moment. And again, thank you for reading the book. You know, the Jordanaires were doing sessions when I got back to Nashville in 2001. So I did a lot of projects and I'd bring them in. I brought them in on a Jimmy Webb album on a song called Elvis and Me. And they sang the backgrounds on that song, which you should listen to. It's absolutely wonderful. I adored them. And of course, they were the backing band, a backing singing group for Elvis on all those hits. And so, yes, one of my bucket list moments was I went to my engineer and I said, listen, I'm going to go in the studio and go to the mic and sing Teddy Bear and ask the Jordanaires if they'll back me up. And we recorded it. And you know what, Harvey? We've lost the files.
What? You don't have it anymore?
No, can't find the files. But I remember it like it was yesterday, and it was just magnificent because I sing pretty well. So it sounded amazing. And to have those voices behind me, I mean, literally, I would have wet my pants if I had any urine in there, you know, so.
Well, I got to say, you really do sing very well, because when you were imitating Bill Medley, I was really impressed.
Well, you never close your... Yeah. I have to do that a lot of times to tell people who he is, you know. So.
You produced some of the greatest duets, like Johnny Mathis' duet with Billy Joel of the Christmas song, which they did in person. But in most of the duets that you've produced, Fred, the singers did not sing together in person. Does that affect the quality of the finished product if the singers of a duet are not singing together in the same room?
No, I think most of my duets are done separately, you know, because we generally have to deal with things like we've got our finished vocal with the artist, but the person we want to have a duet with is nowhere near us. So I have to go fly somewhere a week later and do their harmony and do their duet parts. When I did the Christmas song with Billy Joel and Johnny, I was in the middle of a Johnny Mathis album, and I called Billy's manager and then was able to email Billy directly. And his response was, oh my God, yeah, I'm there. And so, but he said, when are you cutting the track? Because I want to sing it with Johnny. And so he flew into Nashville, and both Johnny and Billy were in separate booths next to each other with the band live and me conducting it. And it was just magical. I mean, first of all, Johnny killed it. And Billy, I mean, I'll tell you the great thing. And it, are we visual here or only?
Oh, this is visual.
Okay, great.
Yeah, our show is televised in the UK as well as being on YouTube.
Great, because I can give you my Billy Joel face. So at one point in Christmas song, which is chestnuts roasting on an open fire, you know, and they were swapping verses. And at one point, Johnny goes to this big high note in the song. And it's just, again, this is a guy who's like in his 80s, and he just smashed this high note like a pro. And Billy is in the other isolation booth, and I'm looking at both of them. And Billy's face at me went,
oh, wow.
Like, he just could not believe that this incredible legend still had those chops and could hit that note so perfectly. And Billy just, I think as I remember, Billy didn't sing the next line because I think he was too amazed or something, you know?
Well, you know, as a listener, I always feel bad when I find out that a duet was sung separately. It doesn't make me happy. I wish they had been together.
Yeah, it's. You know, I think that started really with the Frank Sinatra duets albums that were done in the late 80s, I guess, or early 90s. None of those duets were ever done together. As a matter of fact, many of them were phoned in on ISDN lines. But yeah, I mean, in a perfect world, they would be together, sure.
Now, Fred, I don't know if you're aware of this, but there's a theme that runs through your book, which I picked up on, and it's this. Time and time again, you produced great albums. I would even say some of them are historically significant, like Jimmy Webb's Angel Heart album, his 10 Easy Pieces album, or Barry Mann's Soul and Inspiration album, or Lamont Dozier's Reimagination. And yet with so many of those albums, the record companies didn't promote them properly, if at all. Why is that?
Well, I think they had bigger fish to fry, you know, as far as artists that they knew were going to sell records. I mean, you sort of go with the hot hand if you're a record label. So, you know, you put all your money into the people that you know are going to sell a lot of records. And then in the old days, at least, they would still make records for art's sake. And I think a lot of these records that I've been able to do over the years like Jimmy Webb or that great Lamont Dozier album I did. You know, he wrote all the great Motown hits, and it was a very unplugged, interesting record. Again, historic as hell. And the label was a small label, so they couldn't really put a lot of money behind it. But in my opinion, it's a Grammy Hall of Fame record because of the historic nature of it. But yeah, I mean, I have no control over what the record does once I hand it over to the label.
But that's got to be so frustrating for you. If no one finds out about the album, they're not going to buy it.
I had to learn that. I had to learn to get over that frustration many, many years ago.
Well, I was very surprised to learn in your book that B.B. King recorded You've Got a Friend in Me, but the song was never released. Do you know why?
I don't know why. I've tried to reach out to Disney Records because they own it to put it out digitally, and they haven't so far. I'm going to keep trying, but it is lovely. It is so much fun. It's him doing You've Got a Friend in Me from Toy Story, but it's real B.B. King. It's got a great swing to it and his beautiful vocals and guitar playing. And that was, you know, priceless sessions for me.
For 17 years between 1984 and 2001, Fred, you were a full-time film and TV composer, and you wrote about the intense frustration you felt when sound mixers drowned out your music with sound effects. Why do you think there's so little appreciation for the musical score in that mixing room?
Well, first of all, the fact that you bring it up, it does make me laugh. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, listen, when you make a record, and one of the reasons why I went back to making records full-time was that I get to oversee the record with the artist. And when it's done because the artist and I have deemed it to be done. And we are, so what you hear is exactly what you want, exactly what I wanted and what the artists want you to hear. When you're doing TV and film music and you're scoring a dramatic episode of something, you're dealing with sound effects on top of your thing, you're dealing with ambient sound they've added, dialogue replacement, Foley replacement noise and sound effects. And then you have a mixer who's mixing all these elements together. And unless they have a director or a producer who is very music savvy, they just throw all the faders up and your music fights all of those other elements. And literally, you just have to put it aside and you've got to go to the next show because it's not about you. With a film and TV life as a composer, you're just a spoke in the wheel. And that's a difficult thing for me coming from the record side where I had such control over what was the final record. And then to go into TV and film for a while, it was quite painful to watch something they, in my opinion, destroyed. But after a while, I just said, you know what? It's a gig. I got to keep doing my gig.
Well, I know it paid the bills, gave you a good income, but I'm so glad you went back to producing records because that's where your heart is. In 1999, you wrote the score and were the musical supervisor for the TV movie about the Monkees, Daydream Believer. Did you ever get to meet any of the Monkees?
I never did, no. That's not true. Sorry, it's not true. Peter Tork was an old friend of a friend of mine, and he came to one of my Sunday night dinners in Nashville. That was fun. That was about, 15 years ago. But I didn't have a chance to ask him a lot of stuff. I don't even think he really knew about the project or that I was involved, but I loved that project. I mean, we did it in Toronto for VH1, and we were able to use the real Monkees music. And so they cast four guys who were the Monkees. They just almost looked like the real guys. And I had to actually teach guys to fake guys who faked. And they were lovely kids, and I loved shepherding them and mentoring them, and then overseeing the shooting of the movie as far as being on stage, on set musical director. And I actually love that film. I think it's very sweet and really pays, well, I think it gives a lot of respect to the Monkees. Yeah.
Yeah, I loved it. If anyone out there is a Monkees fan, you must see that TV movie, Daydream Believer. You know, for many years as a film and TV composer, Fred, you were known as a specialist in the horror and sci-fi genres. So how did a guy with that reputation get hired to produce a bunch of lullabies for Disney?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of left turns in my career. You know, and Harvey, the truth is, my career is really based on one thing. You know, I generally get some sort of request, and it could be something goofy, and I'll say, well, I'll try it. And so, you know, literally, that's a lot of my career was I tried TV and film score and I fell into it very deeply. I tried producing and I fell into it very deeply. You know, when I was called to do the Friday the 13th TV series, I was thrilled to get the gig. And I knew it was going to be sort of a Twilight Zone as opposed to a slasher movie. And we did 72 episodes, and I'm so proud of that series. But then that got me the call to do Friday the 13th, Part 7, the movie, and Part 8, which had Jason in his hockey mask and literally, you know, a million killings and slashings and horrible ways to be murdered. And again, it was a gig, and I did the gig, and I enjoyed doing the gig. And somehow the phone rang at some point, you know, shortly after, probably about, you know, 5 years later. And my friend Jay Landers, who's been a tremendous support to me all these years, bringing me great projects, called me. He said, "Hey, I'm at Disney Records now, and we have an idea to do an instrumental lullaby album, which would be very, very meditative, very new age, very, you know, just put the child to sleep music using Disney songs, and you would arrange them and play them as lullabies, piano and strings, guitar and strings." And of course I said, "Hey, you know, I'll try it, you know." And it's we always say a gig is a gig is a gig. So you take the gig. And so I love the idea of it. And that first album, the Disney Lullaby album, has been my greatest success, certainly as an artist. I mean, it's very successful to this day and it's sort of timeless. But yeah, the question is, Jay did know that I did the horror movies and stuff. So you'd think, you know, would he be concerned that Disney wouldn't like it or whatever? I don't know. But I mean, I'm probably way more well known for my lullaby instrumental music than I am for anything else.
Well, you have just an incredible versatility in your musical toolbox of talent, let me tell you. And over the years, you've seen a lot of changes in the music industry, I would imagine, since those days with Dan Hill and Sometimes When We Touch. What are your thoughts, Fred, about the current state of the music industry?
Well, I mean, again, I get asked this one a lot, I mean, because everyone is very curious. I started at a time it was possible to have a hit. It was really, you know, like when we did Sometimes When We Touch and we were cutting the track and we had listened to the song a million times and we all said to each other, we said, you know, this can be a hit. And in those days, it actually could have been a hit and it turned out to be a hit. There's no possibility of that now. I mean, music is basically free now, first of all. So recorded music is basically free. It's at your fingertips. That's the first part of the equation where the economy and the sort of overall fiscal world of recorded music has been turned upside down. So because of that, and because basically there is no real, for instance, radio used to have such power. You know, if you had a hit on a local station, it would bleed. And then the next thing you know, radio all over the US would play it all over the world. Radio has no power anymore. Only in country music, by the way, does radio still have power for now. With all of these things taken away and the fact that, you know, music is streamed basically for free, we don't have the capacity and the ability to have a shot. There's about 1% chance of anything you do really being heard in some sort of way. And that's a hard one. You know, Harvey, the truth is, if I were starting now, I don't think I would be producing records. I think I'd be doing something else musically, but not producing records, because there really is so little chance of your record being heard in the way you would love it to be heard.
And that means there's so little chance of earning a living.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, same thing goes for TV and film score too, because the competition now for anything, well, again, you know, when I say 1%, I'm talking about the Taylor Swifts, the Beyoncés, etc. In TV and film, I'm talking about, for years, of course, John Williams. You know, even Randy Newman was on the top 10 composers. So they're the 1%, you know, the Thomas Newmans and these brilliant, brilliant top-of-the-line composers. But the other 99% are in such competition with each other. And for instance, again, technology, you can now write an entire score that I was doing, let's say, for one of my TV series on a laptop with nothing but software in the laptop and a little extra keyboard, you know, that attaches to the laptop. And you can be as competitive as I was with a full-on studio and racks of gear and racks of keyboards. So every composer out there has to now compete and audition with about 150 people. And at least 100 of them will do it for nothing. And because they know the back end, you get some royalties. And they also want, they want to get in. But, you know, if some of these guys are working on their computers and doing incredible work. So, I mean, the competition is crazy now because anybody can do this score.
It's really frightening. And the message I get from that is that if you want success in this business now, you got to really want it bad and be willing to do anything to get it.
I think you have to have the same drive that I had, but you also have to have the understanding that it won't be easy to make a living.
Well, Fred, I only have one more question for you, and it's based on something you wrote in the book, which really struck me. You said, I'm quoting you here, "I've been so many different people in so many different situations in my life. At times, I feel that I truly am one of those people who has led three or four lives. And I have to read my own list of credits to remember where I was and who I was at a particular time." So, Fred, my question is this. When you look back at that list of credits as a singer-songwriter, a record producer, a film and TV composer, an improv comedian, a TV host, a cult movie salesman, a record label executive, and of course, Fred, the author, which version of Fred Mullen do you like the best?
That's a tough question, but I think I like producing records, and I love working with my artists, and I love working with musicians in the studio. That's my favorite part.
Well, Fred, I can tell you that the version of Fred that I'm seeing today, Fred the interviewee, is pretty terrific.
Thank you so much, man. Really appreciate it. It was a lovely interview, and I so much appreciate it.
Well, it's been such a pleasure meeting you. Thank you for all the beautiful music and the joy you've brought us over the years. Thank you for writing the book. Most of all, thank you so much for taking the time to appear on our show. And thank you for your appreciation of the way I conduct my interviews. That means a lot to me.
It's been a blast. Thank you.
Our guest has been the legendary record producer, musician, and composer Fred Mullen. His new book, Unplugged, Stories and Secrets from a Life of Making Records, Scoring Film, and Working with the Legends of Music, is now available on Amazon and wherever books are sold. For more information about Mr. Mullen, please visit his official website, fredmullen.com. And don't forget to subscribe to his YouTube channel, which is now showing on your screen. My name is Harvey Brownstone. Thank you all for joining us. See you next time. Thank you to my producer, Steve Silver, my managers, Rick Marcelli and Robin Bragg Marcelli of the Marcelli Company in Hollywood, my director of programming, Robert Monaghan, my editor, Isaiah Sharalampadis, and my entire team at the XPTV1 network in the UK.
Thanks for watching. Be sure to check out all the great interviews on the Harvey Brownstone Interviews YouTube channel. Don't forget to subscribe and ring the bell to be notified when new videos are posted.
Don't you deserve a Medicare plan you can count on? Well, you can count on a Medicare Advantage plan from United Healthcare. Enjoy reliable coverage and low out-of-pocket costs with a Medicare Advantage plan from United Healthcare. And if you have a chronic condition like diabetes, chronic heart failure, or a cardiovascular disorder, you may qualify for a United Healthcare Complete Care plan with plans that fit your life today and as your needs change tomorrow. Find out more about United Healthcare plans at uhc.com/Medicare.